Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
What exactly brought you to Illinois?
See, all these movies take place in this small town called Sherman, Illinois, where all the honeys are top shelf. But best of all, there is no one dealing, man. Then it hits me. We could live like fat rats if we were the Blunt Connection in Sherman, Illinois.
And who wouldn't want to be the Blunt Connection? We're about ready to enter the Ask Universe with the Ask Universal talent of Kevin Smith. Hey, Kevin, how are you?
How are you? Excellent to talk to you. And that clip brought back a lot of warm memories, man. That was like, not only, you know, did the boys go to Jane, Tom, Bob, go to Illinois looking for Shermer in that movie Dogma. They don't find it, but they wind up in McHenry instead.
Yes.
And that's where we're headed on November 1st. So we're actually
right.
going to be in a place that I fictionalized in a movie that I had only been in once when I was 9 years old, when we took a cross-country train trip with my whole family, my parents, me and my brother and sister. And we were going to Hollywood, but we stopped in Chicago to see my dad's brother, my uncle. And so he lived in McHenry with his family. So I had gone to McHenry as a kid and spent this wonderful day with my cousins. It was this magical place because, like, I'd met my cousins for the first time. One of them was my age, like, and we were on this trip. It was amazing. And then never got back there. And then years later, when I wrote Dogma, you know, I needed an Illinois town, city that wasn't Chicago. And I was like,
right.
ooh, magical McHenry.
Magical
so it's nice
McHenry.
To actually be going back to magical McHenry for real life. It's been, let me see, I was 9, so I'm 41 years since I've been back in McHenry. I got close. I've been to, like, Crystal Lake. That's very nearby, right?
Yes, it is. The thing, too, that struck me, because I'm always into the music that's used in film, is, and behind that scene, you can hear Magic Moments by Perry Como. How did you arrive? How does a Kevin Smith making Dogma arrive at the decision to use Perry Como's Magic Moments?
We were in a diner, so it felt like we could get away with diner music. We just basically settled on Perry Como because when we were making Dogma, it wasn't too far removed from Christmas, so he'd been fresh in our minds.
Oh,
and we always kind of dug Magic Moments. It's a fun song to make fun of. To singing wise, because you get to go up twice, like Magic Moments. So you get to go down and up. It's a fun seesaw song. So including it, you know, back in those days, it was expensive to get music into movies. But that song was part of an inexpensive catalog. So I remember that was one of the cheaper songs of Dogma as well.
You know, there was a time where I actually, and it wasn't that long ago, where I called the Guild of Music Supervisors or something like that in Hollywood. And I said, you know, I'm really interested in being a music supervisor and getting music for the movies. And he goes, well, you know, basically it's you're like an accountant. I said, what do you mean? You have to meet budgets. That's your job. So like you're saying, you found a package or your music supervisor found a package that didn't cost that much and had
magic moments in it. That person is right. It is very much a job of the boring stuff with contracts. But you are also like the first in line to the director with music ideas.
Mm.
Like basically the director will have some, of course, but like on Jane, Silent Bob Reboot, Amine, who is our music supervisor, she brought in at least 6 songs where I was like, oh my God, this is great. Oh my God, this is great. So the music supervisor is also the job you think it is, which is knowing music enough to be able to present it to a director as an option, as an alternative, as a choice they've never thought of. So, you know, it's not just contracts, although that is definitely a boring part of it, but it's a very creative job as well. And you get to influence the movie and how the movie vibes and feels, because music's such an important component.
Well, now that you say it, I might revisit that.
Don't give up that dream, man. I'm telling
you, up that dream.
That's worth doing, because I'm always up for pushing like the job on anybody that they would always do for free regardless.
Right.
So like if you can get paid for that job, it's like winning the lottery. And I'm telling you, that job is a viable gig. Like they need people to say, oh, have you ever heard of this song? This song would be great in this scene. This is a piece of music that's not too costly, but would fit and make your movie immortal. Like, you know, whenever I hear Magic Moments, I think of Dogma. I have no choice. And there are some people out there, not everybody, but some people who identify that song with that movie and stuff. So it's an important job.
Yeah. And, you know, I would be watching a film and all of a sudden songs from the 70s and the 60s are being dropped into like Marvel flicks. And I'm like, wow, I could do that. My daughter is an actress out in Hollywood, and I saw you, I didn't meet you, but I saw you, it might have been 3 or 4 years ago at the Directors Guild building, the director building in L.A.
And the DGA.
Yeah, and you were doing, it was for the LGBTQ community, and you were doing a screening of Chasing Amy.
Yeah. You were at that. I remember that event. I remember when they asked me, I was like, are you sure you want me? I mean, I know, you know, the character is gay, but like there have been actual gay filmmakers since that movie was made. You might want to give them a slot. But it was an anniversary. It was our 20th? Yeah, 20th anniversary.
Well, my
daughter, they were celebrating. It was very sweet of them. And so I got to go speak, and it was very fun. How weird that you were in the audience, man.
Well, no, I wasn't in the audience. I was with my daughter's entourage, because she was in a show on Amazon called Transparent. And so Transparent was doing PR, like, in the next room. So I just hung around that's how that worked. Yeah.
And, look at that. We were under the same roof for the similar event. That's wild.
And I was just like to say, you don't have to be an animated superhero to have your own movie franchise. Look at your franchise, Kevin. I mean, wow. This goes on for literally over decades and starts with a very innocent, in my opinion, movie Clerks in 1994. Did you ever envision an arc, a story that kept going and going and going from 1994 to like literally to today?
Certainly not till now, but in the beginning, you know, when Clerks got picked up, you know, naturally after the conversation is done, people always go like, what's next? And so I would always kind of say, oh, this is part one of a trilogy. This is a trilogy of movies all connected. The Jersey Trilogy, it's called. And, you know, I did not have three scripts, and they were not all connected. But, you know, I was like, I might as well ensure future work. Like, maybe by saying this, they're like, oh, well, he's only got two more movies. Let's let him do it and stuff. So it was always about preserving the career. Always about, like, all right, well, maybe I can do this, and then it ties back into the movies. I loved having all the characters connected. I love having, you know, because I stole that from John Hughes, as you heard in the clip in the beginning. That comes right out of Hughes' body of work. He didn't go overboard with, like, having his characters cross over, but all of the Hughes canon that I grew up watching as a teenager loosely set in this fake town of Shermer, Illinois. So for me, it was kind of similar, where I was like, oh, I would love to have a world where, you know, like everybody kind of knows each other and stuff. I'm going to take it one step further and have it be interconnected, and these characters will show up in this movie. So I thought I'd do it and get away with it for like three flicks max. But the fact that we're still doing it 26 years later, it's not even a testimony to the quality of the work as much as the tenacity of the guy who makes the movies. I just won't go away. And I just won't let my dopey ideas die. So I'm like, all right, man, remember Jane, Son, Bob? Here's some more of them.
And that brings immediately to my mind, why was Bob silent?
Yeah, what a great question. I wasn't meant to play Silent Bob. I'm not that ironic a joke maker where I'm like, I'm going to take the most chatty person I know myself and stick him into the role of Silent Bob. I wrote the role of Randall to play, the guy in the video store who had all the best jokes and stuff. Yeah. And then as I got close to making the movie, I was like, I'm never going to be able to memorize all this dialogue. But I wanted to be in the movie, so I was like, all right, I'll play Silent Bob. That way I don't have to memorize dialogue. So I wound up kind of backing into that part, and I kept casting Jason over and over again because I love Jason Mewes. Yeah. And so I kept coming back as Silent Bob. And it was like a great irony being trapped in a character who never gets to talk except like once in the movie when I clearly have so much to say. That's why I fell in love with podcasts. That's why we've been podcasting for, 13 years at this point, because I'm like, finally I could say whatever I want. I don't have to hide behind a dopey character and say nothing. I get to be my natural self.
The podcast, which you will get to some more information on that down the road a little bit, and also the reason why we happen to be talking on the phone in just a few minutes. But first, I got to ask the silent part never had to do with Harpo Marx or Penn and Teller or Zorro's assistant, Ronaldo. It was just because you didn't want any dialogue. You didn't want to memorize.
No, well, the character was created, you know, before I took the character's part. Like, I wrote the character Silent Bob.
Right.
I was going to have my friend Mike Bellicos play it. But instead, I wound up taking the part. But, absolutely. Teller is a huge influence, and I've actually gotten to tell him in person. Harpo Marx, you see a lot more of Harpo as I grow as a performer. If you look at me in Clerks, I'm just a guy not saying anything. Wow. When I get to Mallrats, I'm a guy who starts pulling stuff out of his magic coat like Harpo. And then by the time you get to, like, say, Clerks 2 or Jane Silent Bob Reboot, the performance is very Harpo, very animated. Like, I finally figured out along the way, like, look, just don't take up space and not talk. Like, you've got to convey stuff and whatnot. Yeah. So you start getting more comfortable and you start getting more animated. You start paying more homage to all these silent performers that have come before you and stuff. But it was never the intention to play the part. But those characters definitely played a role in developing the part of Silent Bob for sure.
Yeah, and I love the sign in Clerks. If you plan to shoplift, be sure to let us know. Tickled. It's just like that movie was so.
And you think about like the amount of time that I hand wrote that sign. So when we made the movie back in '93, so 27 years ago, I made that sign. 27 and a half years ago, it took me, that's my handwriting. So it took me about maybe tops 30 seconds to write that sign. That joke was worth the investment of 30 seconds. It is paid. Insane dividends on the 30 seconds that it took me to write that. And then I had to replicate it when we did Clerks 2. And people were like, I remember like the art director came up to me and he's like, this, it's close, man. I paused the movie and I put this up to the screen and then I traced it and then I blew it up. And so it looks as close as possible. And I was like, look, you want to get as close as possible? I'll just do it right now. And so I wrote a new one and hung it up and stuff. So it's weird, like, when you have time on your side, when you've got a long tail and you've been around for a while, you're lucky enough to still be in the business, you start to realize these unimportant gestures, these things that you didn't take long to think about, become legacy, become legendary to an audience, like, become larger than life.
That's right. You
start to realize, like, oh, my God, thank God I didn't give it any consideration. I would have overthought it, and it wouldn't be what it was. But that dopey little joke that I literally hung up just because I wanted to hide stickers that were on the cash register. So I was like, well, we got to hide this stuff. I might as well write a joke on it.
Yeah.
Like, become something that lasts for people. That means the world. Thank you for remembering that.
No, I really love to hear stories of something that not maybe throwaway is not the right word.
It is throwaway. That was absolutely throwaway.
That suddenly skyrockets into the ionosphere of pop culture and is remembered literally forever. I know what you're talking about.
Let me tell you, it feels amazing when you can add a spoke to the wheel. I didn't create nothing new, man, but like to add a spoke to the wheel, to be a part of pop culture, you got to remember, like, my characters, they reference pop culture like crazy. To now be a part of pop culture to the point where my characters can reference me in Jay and Silent Bob Reboot.
Oh,
they knew who Kevin Smith was. Yeah. It just becomes so oddly meta, but fun for the filmmaker, at least. I don't know about the audience.
720 WGN, John Landecker talking with Kevin Smith, and we will do more when we come back.
Mubi, the Golden Calf, created by Nancy Goldruff, a former kindergarten teacher in 1989, bought by the Complex Corporation in 1991, broadcast nationally as the Mubi Funtime Hour. Since its inception, has spawned 2 theatrical films, 16 records, 8 primetime specials, and a library of price-to-own video cassettes. Not to mention bi-coastal theme parks, dubbed Mubi World. Did I miss anything?
You forgot Mubi Magazine.
Yeah, 720 WGN, John Landecker really enjoying time with Kevin Smith, the man behind Clerks, Silent Bob, Jay, the whole... Magosh, you know what I'm talking about. Let's get to what you're going to be doing in the Chicagoland area now that we've taken a clip from Dogma that goes into that Mubi storyline, so to speak.
And, yeah, it was that's a deep cuts clip, man. I was so delighted to listen to a young Ben Affleck.
You know what?
That was him. He was so good.
I love Ben Affleck. It just blows my mind the way that you guys, get along, show up in other people's movies along with Matt Damon, make fun of yourselves, don't take anything seriously. I really enjoy that kind of attitude, and I just get a kick out of it. That's all. And I think both of those two are great actors and movie makers. So
they absolutely are. They're wonderful, and they were great enough to hang out with us back in the 90s, and then. They just came back recently in Jay and Silent Bob Reboot. Both Ben and Matt were in that movie as well. And Ben gave a tremendous performance. He's got a gut-wrenching monologue in that movie, which is supposed to be a comedy, and it is. But it's a crazy emotional monologue if you're a parent. It's about being a parent. It's beautiful stuff. But Mubi's was the fake fast food joint from Dogma, and then I brought it back in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, as Jay and Silent Bob were going to Hollywood, they stopped at a Mubi's because they had already eaten at one, in Dogma, which was ironically in Illinois in the movie, outside McHenry. Then in Clerks 2, the entire movie was set inside this fake fast food joint. And then just recently in Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, Jay and Silent Bob on their way back to Hollywood stopped at Mubi's again. So I've used it in a bunch of my flicks, recurring fake fast food joint modeled on, of course, McDonald's and Burger King, but their corporate logo is a sacred cow, golden calf. Mubi,
sure,
the golden calf.
Well, Sunday, November 1st. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Nope. No worries. It's we're actually doing them in real life now, these movies, as a pop-up. So we did it out here in Los Angeles in West Hollywood for like 2 months. We created a fake movies and had real food and stuff. And then we did it in Jersey a month and a half ago. We found another restaurant. They reached out to us, Gianni's, and they were like, can we do it? So we reskinned their restaurant for a week. It was movies. And now we're coming to Chicago October 30th to November 6th. Mubi's is taking over St. Lou's Assembly right there in the Loop. So we're going to have the fake fast food experience there. So me and Jay are coming to town. And we're going to cut the ribbon on the 30th to open the joint. We're going to hang out on the 31st because Halloween, nobody got anywhere to go. And then on November 1st, we go out to McHenry and do our show, Jay and Silent Bob Get Old, at the McHenry Outdoor Theater. So we got it's a Midwest movies week for us, man. And I'm in the middle of like a 5-day fast right now that I'm going to break at that movies. Yeah, I can't wait, man. They got some oat milk soft serve ice cream. Yeah. I'm going to just put my mouth under the machine and drink it all. So the food is actually delicious, man. The pop-up has been fun. We sell, t-shirts and souvenirs and stuff like that. But the food is actually legit good. And so we were going to do outdoor dining in Chicago, and then they just changed the rules recently because of clamping down. So now it's just pivoting to pickup. You go in, the meals are reserved, so you can't just show up when you want to. You go to moviespopup.com and make a reservation. Then you show up, and your food's already pre-ordered. We have inside the place a bunch of dioramas for you to take pictures. There's a fake quick stop, fake RSD video, and stuff like that. And then Jay and I will be there for the first 2 days. And then everyone else who comes until November 6th, pop in, get food, take pictures, head home, eat your movies. The food is actually legit good, man. It's like the Chef Royce, who's our cook out here, developed it and turned it into edible food that is actually tasty. So I'm looking forward to stuffing when I get there. I mean, I get the food free, right, John? So, like, I'm going to get as much of it as possible.
I was looking at that menu, and I was intrigued to see Beyond Meat, Beyond Burger, which I know is plant-based and, as a matter of fact, is one of my favorite ways to go.
I love that Beyond Burger, man. I went vegan after the heart attack. When we started doing this, I was like, I got to have vegan food on the menu. I can't have a movies where I can't eat at it. So Beyond, the good folks at Beyond Meat teamed up with us, and we were able to offer vegan options. So, yeah, you got non-vegan and vegan options. I know we're in cow country, and, of course, that's sacrilege to talk about not eating. But it's good, man. I swear by that Beyond Burger. Yeah. It's so tasty.
Did you happen to see – I'm changing the subject completely. Well, have you happened to see the Netflix documentary called Game Changers?
No, of course. Absolutely. I'm a vegan, and then I look at them, and I'm like, well, how come I don't look like them? And I realize it's not enough to be a vegan. You actually have to work out and do all that other stuff as well.
Yeah.
But that documentary is wonderful. Forks Over Knives is another great one.
Right.
It's weird to be, I'm age 50, and you wouldn't necessarily think of me as a health advocate, but like post heart attack, I've become very educated on the things that take us out early in life. My old man died at 67 of a massive heart attack. So I was 47 when I had mine. So, obviously I'm doing way poorer than he was. And I know he was not a shining example of health, a paragon of virtue either. So, it just became time to start getting smart about my health. And then, the nice thing is I went plant-based and went vegan after the heart attack. Mm-hmm. And I dropped a bunch of weight. And then people go like, man, you look good. How'd you lose weight? And then when you tell them, they don't want to know. And you're like, I went vegan. They're like, vegan, I hate that stuff, man. Now I'm going to eat twice as much meat. And I'm like, well, that doesn't really help. But,
yeah.
But I don't try to recruit people. No. Like, I would not have gone vegan were it not for my heart attack. But thank God I did. It saved my life.
Yeah. And we're backing up a little bit. Where did you and Jason first make contact with one another? I'm talking like way back in, it's got to be at least
way back in the day.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. It's even before that. I've known Jason since the 80s. We grew up in the same town together, Highlands, New Jersey, which is technically not a town. It's so small. It's actually a borough. So it's on the Jersey Shore. It's not too far from Asbury Park. Most people know Asbury Park because of the boss, because of Bruce Springsteen.
Right.
So we grew up down there about three blocks from each other. I've known him since 1988, but I knew him before that, not knew him, but knew him as the town reprobate. Like, there's that Muse kid. He broke the window.
Yeah.
There's that Muse kid. I hear he's a stoner. So I'd always heard about him before I actually became friends with him and stuff, saw him from a distance. But we've been friends since 88, so I've known him for, 32 years at this point. Longest, relationship of my life, other than my parents, I guess, my brother and sister is Jason Mewes.
So, I mean, long before making movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the reason Jane, Silent Bob exists. Like, it's all based on who he was when he was 16 years old. Even then, I was like, man, you're funny. Like, he was the funniest person we knew. And I, long before I wanted to make movies or knew I wanted to be a filmmaker, I was just a movie fan. So I'd always say, like, man, somebody should put you in a movie one day. Like, I want to see if you're as funny outside of New Jersey as we think you are. And then years later, I wound up being that person that put him in a movie one day. And I was smart to do so. He's a true American original.
The only reason
you probably know my name at this point is because he's so good at being himself. He was so good at being that character. And I was just smart enough to be like, I'm going to take you and stick you into a movie. The same things you say to me in real life, just say over here. And I'm not even going to change your name. Your name is the exact same name. So have fun. So in exchange for that, like, I gave him a life where he got to be himself kind of for a living. But in exchange for that, he was the rocket sauce that got us, to the moon. And he still is to this day. He's absolute joy. People see him and they light up, man. He's just fun for them to actually see.
Well, his way of delivering dialogue spiced with obscenities is one of my favorite things. And
you and me both.
Does he? Do you write that, or does he just ad lib it?
It's basically like it's written, but then it's also written to who he was when he was like 16 years old, and then it also incorporates whatever new stuff he drops throughout our lives together. So I've just got a real good ear. You know, I can't even take credit for it. I just kind of wrote down funny things that he said. And then, you know, once you find where that line is, then you just start writing to that line. You know, he's got this interesting delivery where he can say some of the most reprehensible things, but he doesn't seem to be saying them from a place of malice or creepiness. Uh-huh. He's got this childlike innocence to him, even at age 45, that allows him to, like, drop these things out of his mouth, and you go, like, holy crap. So I was always very jealous of him. I was like, man, to be as cute as you and saying all these things, you know, you're just, nobody sees it coming and stuff. So it's a bit of both, but it's definitely Jason, like, at the root of that character, or at least who he was
right
when he was younger. And now every time, when we just did Jane, Silent Bob reboot last year, you know, he has to remember how to be that guy, because now he's a dad and he's a little more grown up and stuff. Well, so it's weird. In the beginning, it was never a performance. It was just Jay being Jay.
Yeah.
And now he's gotten so good at being himself in movies that he had to learn to act so he could remember how to be himself in a movie. It's very strange.
That is a very interesting statement. the 10th anniversary of the podcast, Jay and Silent Bob Get Old. How do you find doing material with no visuals?
Oh, I love it. Are you kidding me? I mean, I got a face for radio. I always wanted to be in radio more than anything else. That's why podcasting appealed to me so much, because I'm like, oh, it's like being in radio, but you can curse your full head off. Thank the Lord.
Yes, that's true.
And so I used to love going into radio shows and visits and stuff like that. Podcasting allowed me to kind of start saying whatever I wanted and create shows with my friends and whatnot. So I've, you know, always loved hearing the sound of my own voice, obviously. and sitting next to him for the last 10 years as we do that podcast, Jane, Silent Bob Get Old, is a very easy gig for me. I just kind of keep the roller coaster on the rails, but it's all fueled by his stories and it's fueled by his mission to stay sober. At the root of the show, Jane, Silent Bob Get Old, is an AA meeting where everybody else is drinking except the one guy on stage who's talking. And so I get to stand next to him or sit next to him. That's how easy the job is, John. We actually sit through the show. So I get to sit next to him and just recount tales of our youth, you know, and guide him through tales of his drug-addled days and whatnot. Yeah. And then we find out, like, how long he's been clean and sober, like you do at any AA meeting. And people have a great time. We've been doing it for a decade, man, and it bought the dude his house, for heaven's sake. Movie business never bought Jay his house. Podcasting live, doing live shows, Jay and Silent Bob Get Old, that afforded him his own house. That's where he's got his wife and his kid right now.
You know, it also allows your viewers, your fans, however you want to refer to them, to also grow with you, because they're all going to face different challenges as they get older, and they're not going to be that person that they were back in their early 20s. And you're sort of like leading the way for them, in a sense. If Jay and Silent Bob...
If anything, they're leading the way for me, to be honest with you. Those cats have been my bosses since 1994, since I had something to sell. And then slowly over time, I realized, oh, you're a filmmaker, but really, you're a salesman, and you sell Kevin Smith. And you sell Kevin Smith in various degrees. Either he's a filmmaker, either he's a podcaster, either he's got a TV show, either he's doing this or that. But at the end of the day, like, I got to be myself for a living, which was something that comes directly from radio. Like,
yes,
you know, growing up, I always listened to Howard Stern, and I marveled at, like, wow, he got to be himself for a living. Mm-hmm. He talks to his friends. He talks about his life. He's not expected to do anything but be him. And so, you know, I got into the business with film, but slowly I gravitated toward other forms of self-expression, forms that were cheaper. You know, it was a very expensive form of self-expression when you want to make a movie. It's dopiest art form in the world, because that's where the artist is like, I need to self-express. Give me $20 million in Ben Affleck or I can't do it. You know, podcast,
yes.
Just turn the microphone on, and if you got somebody to talk to, great. But if you're by yourself, you can still manage to get a show going. And that, I've only been able to do that for 12 years because I grew up listening to people on the radio. And then all throughout my career, I grew up going into radio shows and talking to people.
Yeah.
And it would always be so adorable because people are always enamored of the movie business. And I was so enamored of radio. And I would sit there and be like, can I get a job here? And they'd be like, you're so funny. And I'm like, no, I'm serious. Because this is like a steady gig, whereas movies come and go and stuff.
Yeah.
Podcasting has allowed me to kind of exercise that muscle, that desire that I've always had to hear my own voice incessantly.
Well, one of the very cool things about this podcast is that it will be performed live on November 1st, that's a Sunday, at the McHenry Outdoor Theater, and then that kicks off an entire festival, almost, with food and activities. And is there a website that you go to?
Absolutely.
What is it?
If they want to reserve spots at Movies, or if they want to go see Jay and Silent Bob Get Old in McHenry, the website is moviespopup.com, moviespopup.com. Awesome. We'll get you handled, trust me. We're going to be there for like 4 days. Me and Jay are here in town. So, or they're in town. I'm still in Los Angeles.
Right.
We head out there tomorrow. So we're going to be there. I know it's not the most opportune time, and as much as it's getting colder and if there's lots of COVID to duck, but I think with, you know, some mask wearing and hand washing, we'll be fine.
Kevin, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate it. Have a safe flight and a great time when you're back in Illinois.
Absolute pleasure, John. Thanks for having me.